cutting and disapproval that now rose up and enveloped them like a cloud of midges from the queue at the bus stop, from the shopkeepers standing in their doorways, from mothers, from fathers. My own father, short-sighted, peered across the road in the direction of the disturbance.
"That's not Tracy, is it?"
Part 2. Early and Late. 1. I was still a child when my path first crossed with Amy's. But how can I call it fate? Everybody's path crossed with hers at the same moment. As soon as she emerged, she was uncontained by space and time. With not one path to cross, but all paths. They were all hers, like the Queen in Alice in Wonderland. All ways were her way, and of course millions of people felt as I did. Whenever they listened to her records, they felt they were meeting her. They still do. Her first single came out the week of my 10th birthday. She was 22 at the time. By the end of that same year, she once told me, she could no longer walk down the street, not in Melbourne, Paris, New York, London, Tokyo. Once when we were flying over London together en route to Rome, having a casual conversation about London as a city, its virtues and drawbacks, she admitted she had never been on the tube, not even once, and could not really imagine it as an experience. I suggested that tube systems were basically the same all over the world, but she said that the last time she had been on a train of any description was when she'd left Australia for New York 20 years earlier. She was only 6 months out of her sleepy hometown at that point. She became an underground star in Melbourne so very quickly, and it took only 6 more months in New York to remove the qualifier. An indisputable star ever since, a fact that is, for her, devoid of sadness or any trace of neurosis or self-pity. And this is one of the striking things about Amy. She has no tragic side. She accepts everything that has happened to her as her destiny, no more surprised or alienated to be who she is than I imagine Cleopatra was to be Cleopatra. I bought that debut single as a present for Lily Bingham for her 10th birthday party, which happened to be a few days before my own. Both Tracy and I were invited to her party. We were handed the little homemade paper invitations by Lily herself, one Saturday morning at dance class, quite unexpectedly. I was very happy, but Tracy, maybe suspecting she had been included out of politeness, took the invite with a sour look on her face and passed it straight to her mother, who was anxious enough about it to stop my mother in the street a few days later and pepper her with questions. Was it the kind of thing where you dropped your kid off? Or was she, as the mum, expected to come into the house? The invitation said a trip to the cinema, but who'd pay for this ticket? The guest or the host? Did you have to take a gift? What kind of gift were we getting? Would my mother do her a favour and take us both? It was as if the party was taking place in some bewildering foreign land, rather than a 3-minute walk away, in a house on the other side of the park. My mother, with maximum condescension, said she'd take us both, and stay if staying was required. For the gift, she suggested a record, a pop single. It could be from both of us. Cheap, but sure to be appreciated. She would take us down the high road to Woolworths to find something suitable. But we were prepared. We knew exactly what record we wanted to buy, the name of the song and the singer. And we knew my mother, who had never read a tabloid and listened only to the reggae stations, would be ignorant of Amy's reputation. Our only concern was the cover. We hadn't seen it, didn't know what to expect. Given the lyrics and the performance we had watched, open-mouthed, on top of the pops, we felt that almost anything was possible. She might be completely naked on the cover of her single. She might be on top of a man, or a woman, doing sex. She might be holding her middle finger up, as she had, for a moment, on a live children's TV show only the weekend before. It might be a photograph of Amy executing one of her stunning, provocative dance moves, for love of which we had temporarily abandoned Fred Astaire. For the moment we wanted only to dance like Amy, and imitated her whenever we had the privacy and opportunity, practicing the fluid roll of her midsection like a wave of desire passing through her body, and the way she jerked her narrow, boyish hips and lifted her small breasts from her ribcage, a subtle manipulation of muscles we did not yet have, under breasts we had not yet grown. When we got to Woolworths, we rushed ahead of my mother and went straight to the record racks. Where was she? We looked for the white blonde pixie cut, the startling eyes, Such a pale blue they seem grey, and that elfin face, androgynous with its little pointed chin, half Peter Pan, half Alice. But we found no representation of Amy, naked or otherwise. Only her name and the title of the song along the left-hand side of the sleeve, while the rest of the space was taken up with the puzzling, to us, image of a pyramid with an eye hovering above it, which eye was contained in the point of a triangle. The sleeve was a dirty green colour, and written above and below the pyramid were some words in a language we couldn't read. Confused, relieved, we brought it to my mother, who held it up close to her face. She was also a little short-sighted, though too vain for glasses. Frowned and asked if it was a song about money. I was very careful answering. I knew my mother to be far more prudish about money than about sex.
It's not about anything. It's just a song.
You think your friend will like it?
She'll like it, said Tracy. Everybody loves it. Can we have a copy too?
Still frowning, my mother sighed, went to pick up a second copy out of the rack, walked over to the counter and paid for the pair. It was the kind of party where the parents left. My mother, always nosy about middle-class interiors, was disappointed. But it didn't seem to be organized like the parties we knew. There was no dancing or party games, and Lily's mother wasn't dressed up at all. She looked almost homeless, her hair hardly brushed. We left my mother at the door after an awkward exchange.
"Don't you girls look glamorous?"
cried Lily's mother upon seeing us, after which we were added to the pile of children in the living room. All girls, none of them in the kind of pink and diamante ruffled confection Tracy had on, but neither were they in a faux Victorian, white-collared, black velvet dress like the one my mother had believed would be perfect and which she had discovered for me in the local charity shop. The other girls were in dungarees and jolly-looking jumpers or simple cotton pinafores in primary colours, and when we entered the room, they all stopped what they were doing and turned to stare.
"Don't they look nice?"
said Lily's mother again, and walked out, leaving us to it. We were the only black girls, and aside from Lily, knew nobody there. At once, Tracy became hostile. On the walk there, we had argued over who was to give Lily our mutual present. Naturally, Tracy had won. But now she dropped the gift-wrapped single on the sofa without even mentioning it. And when she heard what film we were going to see, The Jungle Book, she denounced it as babyish and just a cartoon full of stupid little animals, in a voice that seemed to me suddenly very loud, very distinct, with too many dropped T's. Lily's mother reappeared. We piled into a long blue car which had several rows of seats, like a little bus, and when these seats had been filled, Tracy, me and two other girls were told to sit in the space at the back, in the boot, which was lined with a filthy tartan rug covered in dog hair. My mother had given me a £5 note in case either of us was expected to pay for anything, and I was anxious about losing it. I kept taking it out of my coat pocket, flattening it against my knee, and then folding it up into quarters again. Tracy, meanwhile, was entertaining the other two girls by showing them what we usually did when we sat in the back of the school bus that took us, once a week, up to Paddington Rec for PE. She got up on her knees, as far as the space allowed, placed two fingers in a V-sign either side of her mouth, and thrust her tongue in and out at the mortified male driver in the car behind. When we stopped, 5 minutes later, on Willesden Lane, I was thankful that the journey was over, but disheartened at the destination. I'd imagined we were heading to one of the grand cinemas in the centre of town, but we were parked in front of our own little local Odeon, just off the Kilburn High Road. Tracy was pleased. This was home territory. While Lily's mother was distracted at the ticket booth, Tracy showed everyone how to steal pick and mix without paying for it. And then, once we were in the dark theatre, how to sit balanced on a flipped-up seat so that nobody behind you could see the screen, how to kick the seat in front of you until the person turned round.
"That's enough now,"
Lily's mother kept mumbling, but she couldn't establish any authority. Her own sense of embarrassment seemed to stop her. She did not want us to make noise, but at the same time she couldn't bear to make the necessary noise it would take to stop us making noise. And as soon as Tracy had understood this, and understood, too, that Lily's mother had no intention of smacking her, or swearing at her, or dragging her out of the cinema by her ear as our mothers would have done, well, then she felt herself to be quite free. She kept up her commentary throughout, ridiculing the plot and the songs and describing the many ways the narrative would violently diverge from both Kipling's and Disney's vision if she herself were in the place of any or all of the characters.
If I was that snake, I'd just open my jaw and yam that fool up in one bite. Or, if I was that monkey, I'd kill that boy as soon as he turned up in my place.
The other party guests were thrilled by these interventions, and I laughed the loudest. Afterwards, in the car, Lily's mother tried to start a civilized conversation about the merits of the movie. A few girls said nice things, and then Tracy, again, sitting in the very back, I had disloyally moved to the second row, piped up.
What's his name? Mowgli. He looks like Kashyyyk, don't he? In our class, don't he?
Yeah, he does,
I called back.
He looks just like this boy Kashyyyk in our class.
Lily's mother took an exaggerated interest. She turned her head right round as we paused at a traffic light.
Perhaps his parents are from India.
Nah,
said Tracy casually, looking away out of the window.
Kashyyyk's a Paki.
We drove back to the house, in silence. There was cake, though it was poorly decorated and homemade, and we sang Happy Birthday, but then we still had half an hour before our parents were to pick us up, and Lily's mother, not having planned for this, looked worried and asked what we'd like to do. Through the kitchen doors I could see a long, green space overgrown with vines and bushes, and I longed to go out there, but this was ruled out, too cold.
Why don't you all run upstairs and explore? Have an adventure!
I could see how struck Tracy was by this. Adults told us to stay out of trouble and to go and find something to do, or go and make yourself useful. But we were not accustomed to being told, instructed, to have an adventure. It was a sentence from a different world. Lily, always gracious, always friendly, always kind, took all her guests to her room and showed us her toys, old and new, whatever we fancied, without any sign of bad temper or possessiveness. Even I, who had been to her house only once before, managed to feel more possessive about Lily's things than Lily herself. I went around showing Tracy the many delights of Lily's room as if they were my own, regulating how long she could hold this or that item, explaining to her the provenance of the things on the walls. I showed her the huge Swatch watch and told her that she mustn't touch it, and pointed out a poster advertising a bullfight, purchased while the Binghams were on a recent holiday in Spain. Under the image of the matador, instead of the matador's name, was printed in huge, curlicue red letters, Lily Bingham. I wanted Tracy to be amazed by this as I had been the first time I saw it. But instead, she shrugged, turned from me, and said to Lily,
"Got a player. We'll put on a show."
Tracy was very good at imaginative games, better than me, and the game she preferred to all others was putting on a show. We played it often, always with just the two of us, but now she began to enlist these half-dozen girls in our game. One was sent downstairs to get the gift-wrapped single that would be our soundtrack. Others were put to work making tickets for the upcoming show, and then a poster to advertise it. Others collected pillows and cushions from various rooms to use as seats, and Tracy showed them where to clear an area for the stage. The show was to be in Lily's teenage brother's room, where the record player was kept. He wasn't home, and we treated his room as if we had a natural right to it. But when almost everything was organized, Tracy abruptly informed her workers that the show would, after all, feature only her and me. Everyone else was to be in the audience. When some of the girls dared to question this policy, Tracy in turn questioned them aggressively. Did they go to dance class? Had they any gold medals, as many as she? A few of the girls began to cry. Tracy changed her tune a little. So-and-so could do lighting. So-and-so could do props and costumes, or introduce the performance, and Lily Bingham could film it all on her father's camcorder. Tracy spoke to them as if they were babies, and I was surprised how quickly they were mollified. They took their silly made-up jobs and seemed happy. Then everyone was banished to Lily's room while we rehearsed. It was at this moment that I was shown the costumes. Two lacy camisoles taken from Mrs. Bingham's underwear drawer. Before I could speak, Tracy was pulling my dress up over my head.
You wear the red one, she said. We put the record on. We rehearsed. I knew there was something wrong, that it wasn't like any dance we'd done before, but I felt it was out of my hands. Tracy was, as ever, the choreographer. My only job was to dance as well as I could. When she decided we were ready, our audience was invited back into Lily's brother's room to sit upon the floor. Lily stood at the back, the heavy recorder on her narrow, pink shoulder, her pale blue eyes full of confusion, even before we had begun to dance, at the sight of two girls dressed in these slinky items of her mother's that, of course, she had probably never seen before in her life. She pressed the button that said record, and by doing so put in motion a chain of cause and effect which, more than a quarter of a century later, has come to feel like fate, would be almost impossible not to consider as fate, but which, whatever you think of fate, can certainly and rationally be said to have had one practical consequence. There's no need for me now to describe the dance itself. But there were things not captured by the camera. As we reached the final chorus, the moment where I am astride Tracy on that chair, this was also the moment that Lily Bingham's mother, who had come upstairs to tell us so-and-so's mother had arrived, opened her son's bedroom door and saw us. That is why the footage stops as abruptly as it does. She froze at the threshold, still as Lot's wife. Then she exploded, tore us apart, stripped us of our costumes, told our audience to return to Lily's room, and stood over us silently as we got back into our stupid dresses. I kept apologizing. Tracy, who normally had nothing but backchat for furious adults, said nothing at all. But she packed contempt into every gesture. She even managed to put her tights on sarcastically. The doorbell rang again. Lily Bingham's mother went downstairs. We did not know whether to follow. For the next 15 minutes, as the doorbell rang and rang, we stayed where we were. I did nothing. I just stood there. But Tracy, with typical resourcefulness, did 3 things. She took the VHS tape out of the recorder, put the single back in its sleeve, and put both items in the pink silk drawstring purse her mother had seen fit to hang on her shoulder. My mother, always late, for everything, was the last to arrive. She was taken upstairs to find us, like a lawyer coming to speak to her client through the bars of a prison cell, while Lily's mother gave a very laboured account of our activities, which included the rhetorical question, "Don't you wonder where children of this age even pick up such ideas?" My mother became defensive. She swore, and the two women quarrelled briefly. It shocked me. She seemed no different in that moment than all those other mothers confronted with the child's misbehavior up at the school. Even a little of her patois came back, and I wasn't used to seeing her lose control. She grabbed us by the backs of our dresses, and we all 3 flew downstairs, but Lily's mother followed us, and in the hallway repeated what Tracy had said about Khashid. It was her trump card. The rest of it could be dismissed by my mother as typical bourgeois morality, but she couldn't ignore Paki. At the time we were black and Asian. We ticked the black and Asian box on the medical forms, joined the black and Asian family support groups, and stuck to the black and Asian section of the library. It was considered a question of solidarity. And yet my mother defended Tracy. She said, "She's a child. She's just repeating what she's heard." To which Lily's mother said quietly, "No doubt." My mother opened the front door, removed us, slamming the door shut very loudly. The moment we were outside, though, all her fury was for us, only for us. She pulled us like 2 bags of rubbish back down the road, shouting, "You think you're one of them? Is that what you think?" I remember exactly the sensation of being dragged along, my toes tracing the pavement, and how completely perplexed I was by the tears in my mother's eyes, the distortion spoiling her handsome face. I remember everything about Lily Bingham's 10th birthday, and have no memory whatsoever of my own. When we reached the road that ran between our estate and Tracy's, my mother let go of Tracy's hand and delivered a brief but devastating lecture on the history of racial epithets.
I hung my head and wept in the street. Tracy was unmoved. She lifted her chin and her little piggy nose, waited till it was over, then looked my mother straight in her eyes. "It's just a word," she said.
2. The day we learned that Amy was to come, one day soon, into our Camden offices on Hawley Lane, everybody was affected by the news. No one was completely immune. A little whoop went around the conference room, and even the most hardened YTV hacks lifted their coffee to their lips, looked over the fetid canal, and smiled to remember an earlier version of themselves, dancing to Amy's early, dirty downtown disco as kids in their living rooms, or breaking up with a college sweetheart to one of her soupy 90s ballads. There was respect in that place for a real pop star, no matter our personal musical preferences. And for Amy, there was a special regard. Her fate and the channels were linked from the start. She was a video artist right down to the bone. You could hear Michael Jackson songs without bringing to mind the images that accompanied them, which is probably only to say that his music had a real life. But Amy's music was contained by and seemed sometimes to only truly exist within the world of her videos. And whenever you heard those songs, in a shop, in a taxi, even if it was just the beats reverberating through some passing kid's headphones, you were sent back primarily to a visual memory, to the movement of her hand, or legs, or ribcage, or groin, the colour of her hair at the time, her clothes, those wintry eyes. For this reason, Amy, and all her imitators, were, for better or worse, the foundation of our business model. We knew American YTV had been built, in part, around her legend, like a shrine to a pixie god, and the fact that she should even deign now to enter our own, British, far lowlier place of worship, was considered a great coup. It put everybody on our version of high alert. My section head, Zoe, convened a separate meeting just for our team, because in a sense, Amy was coming to us, in talent and artist relations, to record an acceptance speech for an award she wouldn't be able to pick up in person in Zurich the following month. And there would surely be many indents to shoot for various emerging markets. I'm Amy, and you're watching YTV Japan. And perhaps, if she could be convinced, an interview for YTV News, maybe even a live performance, recorded in the basement, for the Dance Time charts. My job was to gather all such requests as they came in, from our European offices in Spain and France and Germany, and in the Nordic countries, from Australia, from wherever else, and present them in a single document to be faxed to Amy's people in New York before her arrival, still 4 weeks away. And then, as the meeting wound down, something wonderful happened. Zoe slid off the desk she sat on, in her leather trousers and tube top, under which you could see a glimpse of a rock-hard brown stomach with a gem-like piercing at the belly button, shook out her lion's mane of half-Caribbean curls, turned to me in an offhand manner as if it were nothing at all, and said, "You'll need to collect her downstairs on the day and bring her to Studio B12. Stay with her, get her whatever she needs." I walked out of that conference room like Audrey Hepburn floating upstairs in My Fair Lady, on a cloud of swelling music, ready to dance the length of our open-plan office, spin and spin and spin out the door and all the way home. I was 22 years old, and yet not especially surprised. It felt as if everything I'd seen and experienced over the past year had been moving in this direction. There was a crazed buoyancy to YTV in those dying days of the 90s, an atmosphere of wild success built on wobbly foundations, somehow symbolized by the building we occupied, three floors in the basement of the old Wake Up Britain TV studios in Camden. We still had a huge rising sun, egg yolk yellow and now completely irrelevant, built into our facade. VH1 was wedged on top of us. Our external tubular heating system, painted in garish primary colours, looked like a poor man's Pompidou. Inside was sleek and modern, dimly lit and darkly furnished, lair of a James Bond nemesis. The place had once been a second-hand car salesroom, before either music TV or breakfast TV, and the interior darkness seemed calculated to disguise the jerry-rigged nature of the construction.
The air vents were so poorly finished, rats crawled up from Regent's Canal and nested in there, leaving their feces. In the summer, when the ventilation was switched on, whole floors of people came down with summer flu. When you turned on the fancy light dimmers, more often than not, the knob would come off in your hand. It was a company that set great store on appearances. 20-something receptionists became assistant producers just because they seemed fun and up for it. My 31-year-old boss had gone from production intern to head of talent in only 4.5 years. During my own 8-month stint, I was promoted twice. Sometimes I wonder what would have happened if I'd stayed, if digital hadn't killed the video stars. At the time, I felt lucky. I had no particular career plans, yet my career advanced anyway. Drinking played a role. At Hawley Lane, drinking was mandatory. Going out for drinks, holding one's drink, drinking others under the table, never declining a drink, even if on antibiotics, even if ill. Keen, at that point in my life, to avoid evenings alone with my father, I went to all office drinks and office parties, and I could hold my alcohol. I'd been perfecting that very British skill since the age of 13. The big difference at YTV was that we drank for free. Money sloshed around the company, freebie and open bar, two of our most repeated office nouns. Compared to the jobs I'd had before, even compared to college, it felt like being in an extended period of playtime in which we were forever expecting the arrival of adults who never appeared. One of my earliest tasks was to collate the guest lists for our departmental parties, of which there was about one a month. They tended to be in expensive venues in the centre of town, and there were always loads of freebies. T-shirts, trainers, mini-disc players, stacks of CDs. Officially sponsored by one vodka company or another, unofficially by Colombian drug cartels. In and out of the bathroom stalls we trooped. Next morning, walks of shame, nosebleeds, holding your high heels in your hands. I also filed the company's minicab receipts. People booked minicabs back from one-night stands or to airports to go on holiday. They booked them in the wee hours at weekends, to and from all-night off licenses or house parties. I once booked a cab to my Uncle Lambert's. An executive became office-wide famous for booking a cab to Manchester, having woken up late and missed the train. After I left, I heard there was a clampdown, but that year the annual bill for transport was over £100,000. I once asked Zoe to explain the logic behind it all, and was told that VHS tape, which employees were often carrying upon their person, could be corrupted if taken on the tube. But most of our people didn't even know this was their official alibi. Free travel was something they took for granted, as a sort of right that came with being in the media, in which they felt to be the least they deserved. Certainly, when compared to what old college friends, who had chosen, instead, banking or lawyering, were finding each Christmas in their bonus envelopes. At least the bankers and lawyers worked all hours. We had nothing but time. My own calls were usually done and dusted by 11:30, bearing in mind I arrived at my desk around 10. Oh, time felt different then. When I took my hour and a half for lunch, that's all I did with it. Lunch. No email in our offices, not quite yet, and I had no mobile phone. I went through the loading bay exit, straight out to the canal, and walked along the water's edge, a plastic-wrapped, quintessentially British sandwich in my hand, taking in the day, the open-air drug deals and the fat mallards quacking for tourist breadcrumbs, the decorated houseboats and the sad young goths hanging their feet over the bridge, bunking off school, shadows of myself from a decade before. Often I went as far as the zoo. There I'd sit on the grassy bank and look up at Snowdon's aviary, around which a flock of African birds flew, bone-white with blood-red beaks. I never knew their names until I saw them on their own continent, where they, anyway, had a different name. After lunch I strolled back, sometimes with a book in hand, in no particular hurry, and what's astonishing to me now is that I found none of this unusual or a special piece of luck. I, too, thought of free time as my God-given right. Yes, compared to the excesses of my colleagues, I considered myself hard-working, serious, with a sense of proportion the others lacked, the product of my background. Too junior to go on any of their multiple company bonding trips, I was the one who booked their flights. To Vienna, to Budapest, to New York. And privately marvelled at the price of a business class seat, at the very existence of business class. Never able to decide, as I filed away these expenses, if this sort of thing had always been going on, all around me, during my childhood, but invisible to me at a level above my awareness, or if I had come of age at an especially buoyant moment in the history of England, a period in which money had new meaning and uses, and the freebie had become a form of social principle, unheard of in my neighbourhood, and yet normal elsewhere. Freebism. The practice of giving free things to people who have no need of them. I thought of all the kids from school who could have done my present job easily, who knew so much more than me about music, who were genuinely cool, truly street, as I was everywhere wrongly assumed to be, but who were as likely to turn up at these offices as go to the moon. I wondered, why me? In the great piles of glossy magazines, also freebies, left around the office, we now read that Britannia was cool, or some version of it that struck even me as intensely uncool. And after a while began to understand that it must be on precisely this optimistic wave that the company surfed. Optimism infused with nostalgia. The boys in our office looked like rebooted mods, with kinks haircuts from 30 years earlier, and the girls were Julie Christie bottle blondes in short skirts with smudgy black eyes. Everybody rode a Vespa to work. Everybody's cubicles seemed to feature a picture of Michael Caine and Alfie, or the Italian job. It was a nostalgia for an era and a culture that had meant nothing to me in the first place. And perhaps because of this I was, in the eyes of my colleagues, cool, by virtue of not being like them. New American hip-hop was brought solemnly to my desk by middle-aged executives who assumed I must have some very learned opinions about it, and, in fact, the little I knew did seem a lot in this context. Even the task of chaperoning Amy that day was given to me, I'm sure, because I was assumed to be too cool to care. My disapproval of most things was always already assumed. "Oh no, don't bother asking her, she wouldn't like it," said ironically, as everything was back then, but with a cold streak of defensive pride. My most unexpected asset was my boss, Zoe. She had also begun as an intern, but with no trust fund or moneyed parents like the rest, nor even, as I had myself, a rent-free parental crash pad. She'd lived in a filthy chalk farm squat, remained unpaid for over a year, and yet came in every morning at 9. Punctuality was considered at YTV an almost inconceivable virtue, where she proceeded to work her arse off. A foster care kid originally, in and out of the group homes of Westminster. She was familiar to me from other kids I'd known who'd gone through that system. She had that same wild thirst for whatever was on offer, and a disassociated, hypermanic persona, traits you sometimes find in war reporters or in soldiers themselves. Rightfully, she should have been fearful of life. Instead, she was recklessly bold, the opposite of me. Yet in the context of the office, Zoe and I were viewed as interchangeable. Her politics, like mine, were always already assumed. Although in her case the office had it quite wrong, she was an ardent Thatcherite. The kind who feels that having pulled herself up by her own bootstraps, everybody else better follow her example and do the same. For some reason she saw herself in me. I admired her grit, but did not see myself in her. I had been to university, after all, and she hadn't. She was a cokehead. I wasn't. She dressed like the Spice Girl she resembled, instead of the executive she actually was. Made unfunny sexual jokes, slept with the youngest, poshest, floppiest-haired, whitest indie boy interns. I prudishly disapproved. She liked me anyway. When she was drunk or high, she liked to remind me that we were sisters, two brown girls with a duty towards each other. Just before Christmas, she sent me to our European Music Awards in Salzburg, where one of my tasks was accompanying Whitney Houston to a soundcheck. I don't remember the songs she sang. I never really liked her songs. But standing in that empty concert hall, listening to her sing without backing music, with no support of any kind, I found that the sheer beauty of the voice, its monumental dose of soul, the pain implicit within it, bypassed all my conscious opinions. My critical intelligence or sense of the sentimental, or whatever it is that people are referring to when they talk about their own good taste, going instead straight into my spine, where it convulsed a muscle and undid me. Way back by the exit sign, I burst into tears. By the time I'd got to Hawley Lane, the story had done the rounds, although it did me no harm. Quite the opposite. It was taken to mean I was a true believer. 3. It seems funny now, pathetic almost, and maybe only technology can achieve this comic revenge on our memories, but when we had an artist coming in and needed to make a dossier on them, to give to interviewers and advertisers and so on, we would go down to a little library in the basement and pull out a 4-volume encyclopedia called The Biography of Rock. Everything in Amy's entry, major or minor, I already knew. Bendigo-born, allergic to walnuts, excepting one detail. Her favourite colour was green. I made my notes by hand, collated all relevant requests, stood in the copy room by a noisy fax machine, and slowly fed the documents into it, thinking of someone in New York, a dream city to me, waiting by a similar contraption as my document came through to them at the exact same time I sent it, which felt so very modern in the doing of it, a triumph over distance and time. And then, of course, to meet her, I would need new clothes, perhaps new hair, a fresh way of speaking and walking, a whole new attitude to life. What to wear? The only place I ever shopped back then was Camden Market, and from inside that warren of Doc Martens and hippie shawls, I was very pleased to draw out a huge pair of bright green cargo pants of a silky parachute material, a close-fitting green crop top, which had, as an added bonus, the low-end theory album cover art on the front of it, picked out in black, green, and red glitter, and a pair of space-age Air Jordans, also green. I finished with a fake nose ring, nostalgic and futuristic, hip-hop and indie, Riot Girl and Violent Femme. Women often believe clothes will solve a problem, one way or another, but by the Tuesday before she was due to arrive, I understood nothing I wore was going to help me. I was too nervous, couldn't work or concentrate on anything. I sat in front of my giant grey monitor, listening to the whir of the modem, anticipating Thursday and typing, in my distraction, Tracy's full name into the little white box over and over again. It's what I did at work when I was bored or anxious, though it never really relieved either condition. I had done it many times by then, firing up Netscape, waiting for our interminably slow dial-up, and always finding the same three little islands of information. Tracy's equity listing, her personal webpage, and a chat room she frequented under the alias truthteller_Lugon. The equity listing was static, it never changed. It mentioned her stint the previous year in the chorus of Guys and Dolls, but no other shows were ever added, no fresh news appeared. Her page changed all the time. Sometimes I would check it twice in a day and find the song different, or that the exploding pink firework graphic had been replaced by flashing rainbow hearts. It was on this page, a month earlier, that she had mentioned the chat room with a hyperlinked note, "Sometimes truth is hard to hear." And this single reference was all I'd needed. The door was open, and I began to wander through it a few times a week. I don't think anyone else who followed that link, no one but me, would have known that the truth teller in that bizarre conversation was Tracy herself. But then no one, as far as I could see, was reading her page anyway. There was a sad, austere purity to this. The songs she chose, no one heard. The words she wrote, banal aphorisms usually. The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. No one but me ever read. Only in that chat room did she seem to be in the world, though it was such a bizarre world, filled only with the echoing voices of people who had apparently already agreed with each other. From what I could tell, she spent a frightening amount of time in there, especially late at night, and by now I'd read through all her threads, both current and archived, until I was able to follow the logic of it all, better to say I was no longer shocked by it, and could trace and appreciate the line of argument. I became less inclined to tell my colleagues stories about my crazy ex-friend Tracy, her surreal chatroom adventures, her apocalyptic obsessions. I hadn't forgiven her, or forgotten. But using her in this way became somehow distasteful to me. One of the oddest things about it was the fact that the man whose spell she appeared to be under, the guru himself, had once been a breakfast TV reporter, had worked in the very building I sat in now. And when we were kids, I can remember often sitting with Tracy, watching him, bowls of cereal in our laps, waiting for his boring, grown-up show to be over and for our Saturday morning cartoons to begin. Once, during my first winter break from university, I went to buy some textbooks in a chain bookshop on the Finchley Road, and while wandering around the film section, saw him in person, presenting one of his books in a far-off corner of that mammoth shop. He sat at a plain white desk, dressed all in white, with his prematurely white head of hair, facing a sizable audience. Two girls who worked there stood near me, and from behind shelving they peeked out at the peculiar gathering. They were laughing at him, but I was struck not so much by what he was saying as by the odd composition of his audience. There were a few middle-aged white women, dressed in their cosily patterned Christmas jumpers, looking no different from the housewives who would have liked him 10 years earlier. But by far the greater part of his crowd was young black men, of about my own age, holding well-worn copies of his books on their knees and listening with absolute focus and determination to an elaborate conspiracy theory. For the world was run by lizards in human form. The Rockefellers were lizards, and the Kennedys, and almost everybody at Goldman Sachs, and William Hearst had been a lizard, and Ronald Reagan, and Napoleon. It was a global lizard plot. Eventually, the shop girls tired of their sniggering and wandered off. I stayed till the end, deeply troubled by what I'd seen, not knowing what to make of it. Only later, when I started reading Tracy's threads, which were, if you could put aside their insane first premise, striking in their detail and perverse erudition, linking many diverse historical periods and political ideas and facts, combining them all into a sort of theory of everything, which even in its comic wrongness required a certain depth of study and a persistent attention. Yes, only then did I feel that I better understood why all those serious-looking young men had gathered in the bookshop that day. It became possible to read between the lines. Wasn't it all a way of explaining power, in the end? The power that certainly exists in the world, which few hold and most never get near? A power my old friend must have felt, at that point in her life, she utterly lacked. What the fuck is that? I turned round in my swivel chair and found Zoe at my shoulder, examining a flashing graphic of a lizard wearing, on top of his lizard head, the crown jewels. I minimized the page. Album graphics. Bad. Listen, Thursday morning. You're on. They've confirmed. Are you ready? Got everything you need? Don't worry. It's going to be fine. Oh, I know it will be. But if you need some Dutch courage, said Zoe, tapping her nose, let me know. It didn't come to that. Difficult to piece back together exactly what it did come to. My memory of it and Amy's have never had much overlap. I've heard her say that she hired me because she felt we had an immediate connection that day, or sometimes because I struck her as being so capable. I think it was because I was inadvertently rude to her, a thing few people were at that time in her life, and in my rudeness must have lodged myself in her brain. A fortnight later, when she found herself in sudden need of a new young assistant, there I was, lodged in there. She emerged anyway from a car with blacked-out windows and mid-argument with her then-assistant, Melanie Wu. Her manager, Judy Ryan, walked 2 steps behind them both, shouting into a phone. The first thing I ever heard Amy say was a put-down. Everything coming out of your mouth right now is totally worthless to me. I noticed she did not have an Australian accent, not anymore, but neither was it quite American or quite British. It was global. It was New York and Paris and Moscow and L.A. and London combined. Of course, now lots of people speak this way, but Amy's version was the first time I heard it. You're the opposite of helpful, she said now, to which Melanie replied, I can totally see that. A moment later, this poor girl found herself in front of me, looked down at my chest, seeking a name tag, and when she looked back up, I could see she was broken, struggling not to cry. So, we're on schedule, she said, firmly as could be managed. And it would be great if we could stay on schedule. We 4 stood in the lift, silent.
I was determined to speak, but before I managed it, Amy turned to me and pouted at my top, like a pretty teenage boy in a sulk.
Interesting choice, she said to Judy. Wearing another artist's shirt when you're meeting an artist?
Professional. I looked down at myself and blushed. Oh, no, Miss Amy, I wasn't trying to make an...
Judy let out a loud, single laugh, like a seal barking.
I tried to say something else, but the lift doors opened, and Amy strode out. To get to our various appointments, we had to walk the halls, and they were lined with people like the Mall during Diana's funeral. Nobody seemed to be working. Whenever we stopped in a studio, people lost their cool almost immediately, irrespective of their position in the company. I watched a managing director tell Amy that a ballad of hers was the first dance at his wedding. I listened, excruciated, as Zoe launched into a rambling account of the personal resonance Move With Me had for her, how it had helped her become a woman and understand the power of women and not be afraid to be a woman, and so on. As we got away, finally, along another hall and into another lift to make our way down to the basement, where Amy had, to Zoe's delight, agreed to record a brief interview, I worked up the courage to mention, in the world-weary way of 22-year-olds, how dull I imagined it must be for her to hear people saying these sorts of things to her day and night, night and day. As a matter of fact, little Miss Green Goddess, I love it.
Oh. Okay, I just thought...
You just thought I had contempt for my own people.
No! I...
You know, just because you're not one of my people doesn't mean they're not good people. Everybody's got that tribe.
Whose tribe are you in, anyway?
She took a second, slow, assessing look at me, up and down.
Oh. Right. This we already know.
You mean... Musically?
I asked. I made the mistake of glancing over at Melanie Wu, in whose face I understood that the conversation should have ended many minutes earlier, should never have started.
Amy sighed.
Sure.
Well, a lot of things. I guess I like a lot of the older stuff, like Billie Holiday, or Sarah Vaughan, Bessie Smith, Nina, real singers.
I feel like... correct me if I'm wrong, said Judy,
her own broad Aussie brogue untouched by the intervening decades. The interview's not actually happening in this lift.
Thank you.
We got out of the basement. I was mortified, and tried to walk ahead of them all, but Amy skipped in front of Judy and linked arms with me. I felt my heart rise in my throat, as the old songs tell you it can. I looked down, she's only 5'2", and for the first time confronted that face close up. Somehow both male and female, the eyes with their icy, grey, cat-like beauty left for the rest of the world to colour in. The palest Australian I ever saw. Sometimes, without her makeup on, she did not look like she was from a warm planet at all. And she took steps to keep it that way, protecting herself from the sun at all times. There was something alien about her, a person who belongs to a tribe of one. Almost without knowing it, I smiled. She smiled back.
You were saying? She said.
Oh, I guess I feel like voices are... They're sort of like...
She sighed again, miming a glance at a non-existent watch.
I think voices are like clothes,
I said firmly, as if it were an idea I'd been thinking about for years rather than something I was at that moment pulling from the air.
So, if you see a photo of 1968, you know it's 68 from what the people are wearing, and if you hear Janice sing, you know it's 68. Her voice is a sign of the times, it's like history or... something.
Amy lifted one devastating eyebrow.
I see.
She let go of my arm.
But my voice, she said, with equal conviction, my voice is this time. If it sounds to you like a computer, well, I'm sorry, but that's just because it's right on time. You might not like it, you might be living in the past, but I'm fucking singing this time, right now.
But I do like it.
She made that funny adolescent pout again.
just not as much as Tribe or Lady Fucking Day. Judy had jogged up to us.
Excuse me, do you know what studio we're heading to, or do I have to...
Hey, Jude, I'm talking to the youth here. We'd reached the studio. I opened the door for them.
Look, can I just say, I think I really got off on the wrong... Really, miss... I mean, Amy, I was 10 when you first dropped... I bought the single. It's mental for me that I'm meeting you. I'm one of your people.
She smiled at me again. There was a kind of flirtation in the way she spoke to me, as there was in the way she spoke to everybody. She held my chin gently in her hand.
Don't believe you, she said, took my fake nose ring out in one swift movement, and handed it to me.
4. Now there is Amy on Tracy's wall, clear as day. She shared the space with Michael and Janet Jackson, Prince, Madonna, James Brown. Over the course of the summer, she made her room into a kind of shrine to these people, her favorite dancers, decorated with many huge, glossy posters of them, all caught in mid-movement, so that her walls read like hieroglyphics, indecipherable to me, but still clearly some form of message, constructed from gestures, bent elbows and legs, splayed fingers, pelvic thrusts. Disliking publicity shots, she chose stills from concerts we couldn't afford to attend, the kind in which you could see the sweat on a dancer's face. These, she argued, were real. My room was likewise a shrine to dance, but I was stuck in fantasy. I went to the library and took out old 70s biographies of the great MGM and RKO idols, ripped out their corny headshots, and stuck them up on my wall with blue tack. In this way, I discovered the Nicholas brothers, Fayard and Harold. A photo of them in midair doing the splits marked the entrance to my room. They were leaping over the doorway. I learned that they were self-taught, and though they danced like gods, had no formal training at all. I took a kind of proprietorial pride in them, as if they were my brothers, as if we were family. I tried hard to interest Tracy. Which of my brothers would she marry? Which would she kiss? But she couldn't sit through even the briefest clip of black and white film any longer. Everything about it bored her. It wasn't real. Too much had been subtracted, too much artificially shaped. She wanted to see a dancer on stage, sweating, real, not done up in top hat and tails. But elegance attracted me. I liked the way it hid pain. One night I dreamt of the Cotton Club. Cab Calloway was there, and Harold and Fayette. And I stood on a podium with a lily behind my ear. In my dream we were all elegant, none of us knew pain. We had never graced the sad pages of the history books my mother bought for me, drunk from separate water fountains, or taken our seats at the back of any bus. None of our people ever swung by their necks from a tree, or found themselves suddenly thrown overboard, shackled in dark water. No, in my dream we were golden. No one was more beautiful or elegant than us. We were a blessed people. Wherever you happened to find us, in Nairobi, Paris, Berlin, London, or tonight, in Harlem. But when the orchestra started up, and as my audience sat at their little tables with drinks in their hands, happy in themselves, waiting for me, their sister, to sing, I opened my mouth and no sound came out. I woke up to find I had wet the bed. I was 11. My mother tried to help in her way. Look closer at that Cotton Club, she said. There is the Harlem Renaissance. Look, here are Langston Hughes and Paul Robeson. Look closer at Gone with the Wind. Here is the NAACP. But at the time, my mother's political and literary ideas did not interest me as much as arms and legs, as rhythm and song, as the red silk of Mammy's underskirt or the unhinged pitch of Prissy's voice. The kind of information I was looking for, which I felt I needed to shore myself up, I dug out instead from an old stolen library book, The History of Dance. I read about steps passed down over centuries, through generations, a different kind of history from my mother's, the kind that is barely written down, that is felt. And it seemed very important at the time that Tracy should feel it too, all that I was feeling, and at the same moment that I felt it, even if it no longer interested her.
I ran all the way to her house, burst into her room and said, "You know when you jump down into the splits?" She was the only girl in Miss Isabel's dance class who could do this. "You know how you jump into a split and you said your dad can do it too, and you got it from your dad and he got it from Michael Jackson and Jackson got it from Prince and maybe James Brown? Well, they all got it from the Nicholas brothers. The Nicholas brothers are the originals. They're the very first. And so even if you don't know it or say you don't care, you're still dancing like them. You're still getting it from them." She was smoking one of her mother's cigarettes out of her bedroom window. She looked much older than me doing that, more like 45 than 11. She could even blow smoke out of those flaring nostrils. And as I spoke aloud this supposedly momentous thing I had come to tell her, I felt the words turning to ash in my mouth. I didn't even know what I was saying or what I meant by it, really. To stop the smoke from filling the room, she kept her back to me. But when I had finished making my point, if that's what it was, she turned to me and said, very coolly, as if we were perfect strangers, "Don't you ever talk about my father again."
5. This isn't working. It was only about a month after I'd started working for her, for Amy, and as soon as it was said aloud, I saw she was right. It wasn't working, and the problem lay with me. I was young and inexperienced, and didn't seem able to find my way back to that impression I'd had on the very first day we'd met, that she might be a human woman like any other. Instead, my gut reaction had been overlaid by the reactions of others, ex-colleagues, old school friends, my own parents, and each had their effect, every gasp or incredulous laugh. So that now each morning when I arrived at Amy's house in Knightsbridge or her Chelsea offices, I had to battle a very powerful sense of the surreal. What was I doing here? I often stuttered as I spoke, or forgot basic facts she told me. I would lose the thread of conversations during conference calls, too distracted by another voice inside me that never stopped saying, "She's not real. None of this is real. It's all your childish fantasy." It was a surprise at the end of a day to close the heavy black door of her Georgian townhouse and find myself not in a dream city after all, but in London, and only a few steps from the Piccadilly line. I sat down next to all the other commuters as they read their city paper, often picking one up myself, but with the sense of having travelled further, not just from the centre back to the suburbs, but from another world back into theirs. The world that seemed to me, aged 22, to exist at the centre of the centre, the one they were all so busy reading about. "It's not working because you're not comfortable," Amy informed me from a big, grey couch that sat opposite an identical couch on which I sat. "You need to be comfortable in yourself to work for me. You're not." I closed the notebook in my lap, lowered my head, and felt almost relieved. So I could go back to my real job, if they'd still have me, and reality. But instead of firing me, Amy threw a cushion playfully at my head. "Well, what can we do about that?" I tried to laugh and admitted I didn't know. She tilted her head towards the window. On her face I saw that look of constant dissatisfaction, of impatience, which later I would get used to. The ebb and flow of her restlessness became the shape of my working day. But in those early days, it was all still new to me, and I interpreted it only as boredom, specifically boredom and disappointment with me, and not knowing what to do about it, looked from vase to vase around that huge room, she packed every space with flowers, and at the further beauty outside, at the sun glinting off the slate-grey roofs of Knightsbridge, and tried to think of something interesting to say. I didn't understand yet that the beauty was part of the boredom. The walls were hung with many dark Victorian oils, portraits of the gentry in front of their grand houses, but there was nothing from her own century, and nothing recognisably Australian, nothing personal. This was meant to be Amy's London home, and yet it didn't have a thing to do with her. The furniture was of plush, generalised good taste, like any upscale European hotel. The only real clue that Amy lived here at all was a bronze near the windowsill, about as big as a plate and the same shape as one.
at the centre of which you could see the petals and leaves of something that at first seemed to be a lily on its pad, but was actually the full cast of a vagina. Vulva, labia, clitoris, the works. I didn't dare ask whose. "But where do you feel most comfortable?" she asked, turning back to me. I saw a new idea painted on her face like fresh lipstick.